And we now know from this study how dangerous that can be for our patients.
It's not a randomized trial. This is not prospective data.
All right, now guys, it is February. And what's February? February is the month of love. I love bicarb.
Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Really happy that you are joining us to listen to this podcast. This is perhaps one of our favorite podcasts. A look back over the preceding year about what are some key articles that were published as it pertains here to the 2025 emergency medicine, critical care, and resuscitation literature, and what can we glean from those articles as we head now into 2026. Well, before we dive into a high-level overview of those articles, I have to bring in simply my amazing, stellar, outstanding, exemplary co-host here on CCPEM, Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. Peter W. Gentlemen, Happy New Year. I know we're recording just a few weeks here into the new year, but really looking forward to an outstanding year on here on CCPEM in 2026. John, I'm going to start with you, just checking in. How was your holidays and how are things going this recording?
The new year started out great. We've had a really interesting month, I'm sure, across the country. All of us are feeling the cold right now, but we are doing wonderful in Philadelphia. In fact, the Center for Resuscitation Science at Penn is actively getting ready for an exciting resuscitation conference, and this is focusing on cardiac arrest resuscitation. And for anyone interested, if you happen to be around the Philadelphia area the weekend of March 14th, we're going to be hosting a one-day cardiac arrest resuscitation conference where it's a half day of really quick hit, 15-minute cutting-edge resuscitation lectures, followed by a second half of the day of hands-on resuscitation activities where we're going to be teaching things like double sequential defibrillation, some team leadership training, and a few other maybe less frequently performed but high-risk procedures you might need to do in the ED. So if you're interested, check out revive-conference.com. All the information's there, or send me an email. But we are planning furiously for that right now, and it's just around the corner. So we're pretty excited.
That sounds great, John. Well, I know you just said it, but what we can do is include the link in our handout that is accompanied on this podcast. That way, folks, if they don't remember, that can just drop into the handout, click on the link, and then register for what really sounds to be like an outstanding, exciting cardiac arrest conference. So looking forward to hearing, once we get beyond it, how the conference went. Dr. W, how did the holiday period go, and how do we find you as we record this podcast?
So spectacular holiday. And New Orleans is in full swing with carnival season. So it's going, parades, everything else in preparation for carnival for the next 3 weeks. Every weekend, most weekday nights have a parade, events, balls, the whole bit. So it's a good time to be in the city.
Not sure there's ever a bad time, I think, Peter, to be in New Orleans. And longtime listeners know that we get to, every few months, hear what new festival is going on in New Orleans. And hopefully some of you have had the chance to visit or plan to visit here in 2026. Well, you heard John talk about the cold that's hit many of us over the early 2026 period. We're going to turn to Dr. Rodriguez, who happened to let us know before we started recording that he was out hiking in close to 80 degree weather. So, Rob, I hope things are going well on the West Coast, that you had a great holiday season, and how are you this recording?
Yeah, we did have a wonderful holiday season over here. I split my time between Riverside and the Bay Area. And back here, as mentioned, it's lovely. It's the perfect time of year to be in Southern California.
All right. Well, with that, let's turn our attention to the education. And once again, a look back over some key articles in 2025. We are not going to do a tremendous deep dive. Some of these articles we hit throughout the course of 2025. And what I would do is direct your attention to those more in-depth discussions that we did a little bit later. Nonetheless, let's hit the highlights. We're not diving into p-values, but let's start off with the most common critical illness that we see in the emergency department and in the ICU and on the floor, and that is sepsis resuscitation. So what are a few key articles from the 2025 literature that we felt were important to discuss and important for all of you to know about here? Well, the first pertains to blood pressure. This was the OptPress study. This was a study published in Intensive Care Medicine 2025, lead author Endo and colleagues. And I think, as we've all experienced, probably on a daily basis, we resuscitate sepsis. And those that have septic shock have an exceedingly high mortality. Now, we frequently talked about blood pressure targets in resuscitation of patients with sepsis, septic shock. And studies have hinted over the years, well, perhaps in older patients, those with chronic hypertension, maybe driving the MAP higher than the 65 that we're used to in sepsis resuscitation may be beneficial. So the whole objective of this OptPress study was to evaluate the effects of a higher MAP target in older patients, so those over 65 years of age, and in a population of patients that had a high prevalence of chronic hypertension. So this was a study done out of 29 centers in Japan, looked at patients ages 65 years and older, had septic shock, were in the ICU, and then they were randomized either to a high target group, which entailed a target MAP of 80 to 85 through titration of norepi, early administration of vasopressin, or they were randomized to a control group, so the normal values that were used to targeting sepsis resuscitation, 65 to 70 millimeters of mercury. They looked at overall 90-day all-cause mortality, and they included a total of a little over 500 patients, and that's because the trial was stopped early for ineffectiveness and even a suggestion of harm in those patients with septic shock, where the blood pressure was driven to that higher target of 80 to 85 millimeters of mercury. In terms of that 90-day all-cause mortality, much higher in the high target group. All of their secondary outcomes were worse. So, looking at 28-day all-cause mortality, days free with respect to mechanical ventilation, renal replacement therapy, all were worse in those that were randomized to the high target group. And as no surprise, those in the high target group, higher MAPs, had more frequent arrhythmias, more frequent venous thromboembolism, more frequent ischemic events, along with hemorrhagic events. Now, every study has those limitations. We won't do a huge deep dive on this podcast into them, but with respect to the OptPress study, it was relatively focused on a Japanese population, unblinded, and no strict criteria for dosing or tapering vasopressors. But nonetheless, the take-home message from this first study, right out of the gate here on septic shock, is that really targeting a higher MAP, 80 to 85, in patients with septic shock turned out to be a really bad idea, with increases in mortality and increases in safety events. So, Peter, I'm going to turn to you first for some comments. Your thoughts on the OptPress study?
So I love this study. I'm going to tell you why I like this study so much is because when we typically write our pressor orders, we write titrate blood pressure greater than 65. This is an important thing to remind our listeners that they need a back end to that number, right? That we should be writing titrate to a mean arterial blood pressure 65 to 70. Because the untoward effects we get when we just say greater than 65, the bulk of those patients wind up with mean arterial blood pressures close to 80. And we now know from this study how dangerous that can be for our patients. So this is from a take-home message from this study. It drives the point to keep it its right range as your goal, 65 to 70, and it's easier for the nurses to follow that
Great,
safely.
great comments, Peter. Let me turn to John next for John, your thoughts on this study.
I think it was a really interesting study, and it is very similar to the sepsis SPAM trial that we reviewed a long time ago that looked at high versus low blood pressure in patients with sepsis and found no difference in 28-day mortality. The difference here is that these patients were a little bit older, So I 100% agree with everything Peter said. I think that having a ceiling on your presser limit is totally reasonable. The only thing I would add is that, as with all these heterogeneous trials, there may be some situations where individual patients might benefit from a slightly higher blood pressure. Those who are chronically hypertensive, or those with significant coronary artery disease or history of stroke, neurologic injury, or if you're just looking at your patient and their perfusion is still poor despite achieving that MAP of 65, it's okay to trial a short period of higher blood pressure, but that doesn't mean you need to stay there. So I agree. I think this was a great trial, excellent addition to the literature, and something that influences my practice for sure.
Really outstanding additional comments, John. Rob, you're getting the final word here on OptPress as we transition here and move on to the next article. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with both Peter and John's comments about that max on your orders. This article really falls in line with pretty much all of the studies that have looked at titrating to higher blood pressure in critically ill patients. Pretty much all of them that we've reviewed over the past 3 or 4 years have found a null or even a negative effect of driving pressures above a threshold of 75 to 80. So I think this article is consistent with all of those articles. I never really have sought to drive my patients' blood pressures any higher than 70 or at most 75 in my patients. So this falls in line with that.
All right. Really outstanding comments on that first article. Let's transition now into the second sepsis article. This was published in JAMA in 2025, and this was the Andromeda Shock 2 trial. In essence, if you recall, a few years ago, I think back in 2019, we reviewed Andromeda Shock 1, or the initial Andromeda Shock trial here on CCPEM. And essentially, that study found that a capillary refill time targeted resuscitation strategy was non-inferior to current baseline or standard of care. And there was an association that those that had their sepsis resuscitation targeted to this capillary refill time or improving capillary refill time may have had faster recovery of organ dysfunction, got less fluid, and may have had a higher likelihood of survival. Well, now the Andromeda Shock 2 trial was published, and in essence, these investigators wanted to look at the efficacy of a personalized hemodynamic resuscitation protocol where they had multiple tiers of a very complex and admittedly a fairly robust but resource-intensive tiered program in terms of resuscitation, really to tailor that personalized hemodynamic resuscitation protocol to tailor fluids, pressors, and inotropes, ultimately driving towards normalizing capillary refill time. So, really, what was the Andromeda Shock 2 trial? This was done at 86 ICUs across 19 countries, whereby they enrolled adults with septic shock either in the ED, ICU, in the operating room, or on the ward. And they randomized them to two groups: a capillary refill time personalized hemodynamic resuscitation group versus usual care. And in essence, we're not going to do a huge deep dive into this capillary refill time personalized hemodynamic resuscitation group, but that was based essentially on four pillars: normalizing capillary refill time by trying to identify the individual patterns of cardiovascular dysfunction in that particular patient, whereby they were looking at pulse pressure, diastolic pressure, did a bedside echo, a systematic fluid responsiveness assessment, and then another hemodynamic test looking at potentially, and we just alluded to this, a higher MAP target or some addition of inotropes. Now, once again, they went into a tier one, a tier two, where they went by a very complex and resource-intensive algorithm based on that individualized care overall between the two groups. So, this personalized hemodynamic resuscitation group versus usual care, their primary outcome was a composite of either 28-day all-cause mortality, the duration of vital support. So this was mechanical ventilation, renal replacement therapy, or hospital length of stay. So that composite of all three of those. In total, in the Andromeda Shock 2 trial, they included about 1,500 patients. And at the end of the day, utilizing a win ratio, which we've highlighted before here on the podcast, it did look like the capillary refill time, personalized hemodynamic group, actually did have a higher composite outcome than usual care. But importantly, when looking at the components of that primary outcome, it wasn't in mortality. In fact, what led to that value was actually a decrease in vital organ support. So lower time getting pressors, lower incidence of initiating mechanical ventilation, or lower time on the vent and/or initiating renal replacement therapy. Now, lots of limitations here. Once again, I already mentioned this, a labor-intensive protocol. Looking at pulse pressure, looking at diastolic blood pressure, a lot of that still requires prospective validation. And perhaps at the end of the day, it may have just been that this 6-hour protocol where they were getting super frequent assessments, maybe it's just simply going back and looking at the patient that frequently may have made the difference in this particular Andromeda 2 shock trial. So overall, yes, this personalized resuscitation protocol targeting normalization of capillary refill time was superior, but it was really driven by a shorter duration of vital organ support. All right, Dr. Rodriguez, I'm going to turn to you first now for your comments on the Andromeda Shock 2 trial.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the personalized approach to resuscitation and sepsis. That's really what we should strive to do, is to not put everybody in the same cookie cutter approach. Recognizing that the protocol that they used in this study is extremely labor intensive, however, and I don't think it's going to be feasible for most ICUs and for most critically ill patients. I do, however, think that what the future in this regard is going to be AI delivered pressors and fluids and so forth, AI driven protocols in which, instead of the physician having to go back and, reevaluate, reassess, and so forth, that process is going to be automated. So I think that that is the future of this approach.
Really insightful there, Rob. I like where you're going with that, and it will be interesting to see where this takes us, given just the explosion of AI algorithms. And as we'll get to actually in our next study, looking at some of these models. But before doing that, Dr. Greenwood, your thoughts on Andromeda Shock 2.
So I think this is a really important trial, and we were a site that participated and enrolled subjects, and I wholeheartedly agree. It is a labor-intensive protocol. However, if you take a step back, the first big takeaway for me is by incorporating capillary refill time into your resuscitation strategy, we're getting back to a perfusion-based target or endpoint in resuscitation, rather than a lot of the surrogates and intermediaries that we've been targeting over the past 15 to 20 years. Mean arterial pressure is great, but if there's not perfusion, it doesn't really matter. Same thing with given an X amount of crystalloid boluses, that if just doing that isn't the real intervention that matters, it's that you've restored blood flow. So bringing Andromeda Shock 1 and 2 to the forefront returned this concept of resuscitation that focuses on restoring tissue perfusion. The second is, and Mike, you kind of alluded to this, is that there's no perfect resuscitation endpoint. We have to go back to the bedside and look at multiple things to determine if what we're doing is making an impact on the patient's clinical care. So it does require us to go back to the bedside, reassess our patients.
Love those comments, John. Peter, You're bringing us home here on Andromeda Shock 2.
So I would just echo exactly what Rob and John had to say. I think the more attention you pay to your sickest patients, the better off they're going to be. When we use tools like CRT, when we use tools like fluid responsiveness, and we follow our patients serially, we're going to do a better job and we're going to see better outcomes and less organ injury. This just echoes that. It supports that mindset.
All right, great thoughts on Andromeda Shock 2. Well, let's wrap up our thoughts on sepsis with respect to articles. And this is one we'll kind of get through relatively quick because we did do a deeper dive on the OVIS trial. So we've talked about higher MAPS with OptPress. We just talked about Andromeda Shock 2. This was the OVIS study, and this dealt with overall thoughts on when do we add vasopressin to sepsis resuscitation in those with septic shock. Recall that this particular study was designed to derive, validate, and measure a vasopressin initiation rule that was optimized to improve both short and long-term outcomes among adult patients who were in septic shock and already receiving norepinephrine. So this was the utilization of one of these reinforcement learning models, whereby investigators used a cohort of data to derive and then several cohorts and databases of data to validate this overall reinforcement learning model and looking at overall its effects on in-hospital mortality or its associations with in-hospital mortality and then secondary outcomes for organ support. And the way they went about this reinforcement learning model, it really was a binary decision. Start vasopressin or don't start vasopressin. And this model was designed to maximize the benefits of essentially, once again, improving mortality, changes in lactate, and also changes in injury severity scores. So, on the whole, the OVIS study included about 14,500 patients. And at the end of the day, this reinforcement learning model, when compared to what happened in real life by clinicians, recommended starting vasopressin earlier at lower norepinephrine doses, at lower serum lactate. And when it turned out that when in real life, the clinician decision matched what the learning model said, that's when mortality was the lowest. Now, certainly this needs a whole lot of continued prospective validation. But the OVIS trial from 2025 would suggest that as we're titrating vasopressors and we're moving from norepinephrine now to consider vasopressin, perhaps we should be starting it earlier to maybe maximize the benefit or lower the mortality in patients with septic shock. All right, Dr. Greenwood, you're leading us off here on thoughts again about the OVIS trial.
So this was an interesting study. Didn't change my practice in any way. This was a large observational study that attempted to be, essentially like a causal inference type thing. This is not a randomized control trial in any way, shape, or form. I find it interesting, not just about the study, but the trend in clinical practice, particularly as we've increased the utilization of peripheral vasopressors, how we've probably moved to using vasopressin a little bit later, and we've increased the max dose of what we will give in terms of norepinephrine through a peripheral IV. Even at Penn, the medical intensive care group has increased their threshold to 20 micrograms per minute, which I think is really high. But I think that it's important to consider early vasopressin. I think this data supports that practice, but it doesn't change the way I practice. If I'm above 10 micrograms per minute or around 0.1 mics per kilo per minute of norepinephrine, I'm considering placing a central line and starting vasopressin.
All right, turn into Dr. W.
Yeah, I think this is one of about half a dozen articles published in the past 18 months arguing for vasopressin and a standardization for the initiation of a second vasopressor. And so this didn't change what we did or what we're doing, but it did help us in our unit at University Medical Center in New Orleans. It helped us standardize a protocol about when we're starting the second vasopressor. This, kind of piled on with these other studies to do that. I'm thrilled by that. I'm still the guy who rails that says, now we've standardized when to start it. My group still hasn't standardized when to get it off. And I think it makes me a little bit kooky on that end, because more is not better in vasopressors. And we know that. We have that data. So.
Oh, great points. Great points. All right, Dr. Rodriguez, final word on the Avis trial.
Yeah, the most interesting thing about this study to me is how it was done. And this is a study where you really have to read the methods and understand what type of study this is. This is basically a target trial emulation type study. In other words, they use these huge data sets and machine learning or AI, whatever you want to call it, to derive a protocol or a suggested protocol. And then they test that protocol on a separate data set. And in this way, you don't have to enroll patients prospectively. It's a very inexpensive way to do a so-called trial. So it's important to understand that's what this study was, because I don't know if I have faith in that, to be honest. It's not a randomized trial. This is not prospective data. It's all kind of in the abstract, in a sense. So I really know what to do with this trial. I am a fan of vasopressin, and I do think that we should probably be starting it earlier, as this study recommends. But until a true randomized trial takes place, I'm not completely convinced.
All right. Outstanding thoughts on Avis trial. Let's pivot away now from sepsis. Let's turn our attention to a study that looked at metabolic acidosis in the critically ill patient. And this was the BICAR ICU2 trial. This was published in JAMA, once again, 2025. And you may recall a few years ago, we also evaluated and discussed the original BICAR ICU trial. And if you remember that, in essence, this was a particular trial that looked at providing sodium bicarbonate for critically ill patients that had severe metabolic acidosis. And the overall primary outcome of that initial BICAR ICU trial actually did not demonstrate a difference in 28-day mortality or organ failure by day 7 in those with metabolic acidosis who received bicarbonate versus those who didn't. However, there was a pre-planned analysis of those that had moderate to severe acute kidney injury. And in that subgroup of patients, there was a signal of improved mortality in those that had metabolic acidosis, moderate to severe AKI, and received bicarbonate. So that really was the foundation of this particular BICAR ICU2 trial, whereby they were assessing a sodium bicarbonate infusion in patients with severe metabolic acidosis and moderate to severe acute kidney injury, and did it change 90-day all-cause mortality? So BICAR ICU2 was performed in 43 ICUs in France in adults who were relatively sick, so a lactate greater than 2 within 48 hours of ICU admission, and within 6 hours had a pH less than 7.2, a lower bicarb, a PaCO2 of essentially 45 or less, so they were excluding those that had a respiratory acidosis. And lastly, they had to have moderate to severe acute kidney injury. These patients were randomized either to get bicarbonate or not get bicarbonate. And in those who received bicarbonate, that was a 4.2% solution, whereby they were giving them aliquots of about 125 to 250 mLs. They could give up to a liter, but essentially they were targeting getting that arterial pH to about 7.3 or higher. Once again, their primary outcome was 90-day all-cause mortality. They enrolled about 640 patients, and the primary outcome was no different. No different between those that received bicarbonate versus those who did not receive bicarbonate. Now, overall, open label design, some limitations with the BICAR ICU2 trial. And in fact, there was a little bit of crossover. So about 47 patients in the no bicarbonate group actually did end up getting bicarbonate. But notwithstanding those limitations, the BICAR ICU2 trial demonstrated that bicarbonate actually didn't change 90-day all-cause mortality in this specific group of patients that had severe metabolic acidosis and moderate to severe AKI. So really maybe disproving what the initial BICAR ICU study looked at in subgroup analysis. So with that, Dr. W, perhaps lead us off here on BICAR ICU2.
Yeah, I don't want to be quoted as being a bicarb hater, but I'm a bicarb hater. I'm not a big fan of this hyperosmolar load unnecessarily just because someone's uncomfortable with the pH. I get it, but I do point to that 90-day all-cause mortality and feel good about my decision not to give bicarb as a standard or a routine for those people with severe acidosis. There are times when we need bicarb specifically. Hyperkalemia comes to mind, certain anecdotal things for toxicology come to mind as well. But as a blanket to treat severe metabolic acidosis, I'm not a fan. But I defer to my colleagues.
We're not going to quote you there, Peter. Rob, I'm going to turn to you next, and then we'll round out. John's going to get the last word here on BICAR ICU2.
Yeah, I used to be a little bit, maybe a little bit of a fan of bicarb in the setting of AKI and acidemia, only in that setting. My rationale was that we give outpatients and otherwise non-critically ill patients part of their treatment when they have AKI is bicarb. We give them bicarb tabs as outpatients. Sometimes they get other bicarb type treatments for patients who have AKI. This study kind of takes away from that. Again, the mortality outcome was very similar. I suppose if you look at the renal replacement therapy indication and maybe not having to give as much dialysis or renal replacement therapy to these patients. So I guess I have overall mixed feelings about this study.
All right, final word, Dr. Greenwood.
All right, now guys, it is February. And what's February? February is the month of love. And I'll tell you, I love bicarb for certain circumstances. I agree with Rob and Peter. I mean, if you look at the results of this study, 50% of the patients were in septic shock, and that's why they had severe metabolic acidosis. Bicarb's not going to fix their septic shock, right? Where the signal was in the patients with renal failure or acute kidney injury. So if I have a patient with a severe metabolic acidosis, a pH less than 7.2 with a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, I'm giving them bicarb. Peter and Robin, you, Mike, as well, have all talked about this in the past and said the same thing. You focus on the intervention that fixes the problem that the patient has. I think that this big heterogeneous trial that enrolled patients who are traumatic causes of acidosis, so hemorrhagic shock, septic shock, whatever. It's not going to fix everything, but in certain patients it will. So I love bicarb for those patients.
All
That's
right. That's interesting. We have a hater, a medium guy, and a lover. So you need to break the tie, Mike. I'm going to lean a little bit more towards Peter there. I think that in many situations, the reflex is sodium bicarbonate, and in many situations, it's not the right answer. All right. Well, John, don't go too far. You wrapped us up there with BICAR ICU2. I'm going to turn to you first for EVERDAC. So let's switch now from metabolic acidemia to a very common procedure that many of us do. Now, we touched already and mentioned vasopressors. And often, when patients are on vasopressors, the reflex is let's get an arterial line in so we can monitor beat-to-beat variations, and we can often titrate our vasopressor therapy. Which brings me to the EVERDAC trial that was published in New England Journal of Medicine 2025, really looking at the utilization of early arterial line placement compared to non-invasive blood pressure measurements. So overall, these investigators wanted to evaluate whether managing critically ill patients with shock without early A-line placement was non-inferior to our general practice of early arterial line catheter insertion with respect to 28-day all-cause mortality. So this trial, done in 9 ICUs in France, adult patients who had circulatory failure, and they were randomized either to a non-invasive strategy group or an invasive strategy group. In essence, in that non-invasive strategy group, an A-line or arterial line was not permitted until the 28th day after randomization, and they utilized non-invasive blood pressure measurements to guide their overall treatment and resuscitation of those patients. In the invasive strategy, if you were randomized to that group, you got an arterial line within 4 hours of randomization, and essentially the use of non-invasive measurements really wasn't allowed unless you needed to replace the arterial line or while it was being inserted. Overall, looked at 28-day all-cause mortality and also looked at adverse events. Not a surprise there. They included just about, actually, a little over 1,000 patients. Most of them were medical. So almost 95% were a medical versus surgical admission. And about a fourth were coming from the emergency department to the intensive care unit. Overall, the primary outcome, once again, 28-day all-cause mortality, no different. No different between this non-invasive strategy versus invasive strategy group. Their non-inferiority thresholds were met. With respect to secondary outcomes, no significant difference, but I think as we would all attest and assume, those that were in the invasive A-line strategy group did more often have a hematoma or hemorrhage. And something I found actually a little bit more surprising until I dove deeper into the study is that more patients in the non-invasive group actually complained of pain or discomfort. And I think at the end of the day, that was because many in the invasive strategy group, I think, were intubated and perhaps couldn't talk. So, nonetheless, a very interesting study. EVERDAC would suggest that delaying arterial catheterization in favor of non-invasive blood pressure monitoring was non-inferior to using early A lines in these critically ill patients with shock. Dr. Greenwood, what say you?
I think this has the chance to be probably the most misunderstood study in 2025. Testing a diagnostic test to determine if it has an impact on mortality that's not tied to our intervention is pretty ludicrous, in my opinion. It doesn't make sense. I think if you look at the patients that were enrolled in this trial, the average norepinephrine requirement was less than 0.5 mics per kilo per minute. So this is a really low dose norepinephrine type requiring shock in sepsis patients. This doesn't change my practice. If I have a patient on 4 mics of norepinephrine, I can check their cuff pressure. It's just fine. But what this study didn't tell me was that I shouldn't be using arterial lines. All it did was confirm my current practice of at low dose vasopressors, I feel pretty comfortable relying on a cuff pressure, but it by no means that I shouldn't be using arterial lines.
Really, really insightful there. Rob, I'm going to turn to you next. Peter, you'll get the final word on EVERDAC.
I actually liked the study. I actually liked it a lot. In fact, it was probably my favorite study of the past year. Recognizing that what John noted, that a lot of these patients were on super low doses of epinephrine, this study aligns with my overall sentiment and practice, and that sometimes we are too quick to reach for an A line, or it used to be Peter, Mike, and I remember when we used to put in a pulmonary artery catheters in everybody. And then there a big study that came out that showed that pulmonary artery catheters made no difference and in fact were associated with worse outcomes. Sometimes more monitoring is not better, and I kind of like the study.
All right, Peter, bring us home.
Yeah, and so I'm in agreement with Rob on this, that more is not necessarily better. And you had brought it up earlier that this discomfort level probably linked to the fact that the people who got invasive monitoring were unconscious and unable to participate. I think the sicker you are, that ART line helps me, not just from a monitoring standpoint, but from a blood sampling standpoint as well. And so that helps me with my decision making. It helps me with fluid responsiveness measurements. So I'm a fan of that ART line, the sicker you are, right? But if you're sitting up in bed and able to communicate with me, you don't need an ART line. That's stupid. That's dangerous. And that sounds like fee-for-service kind of territory to me.
So I love this group in terms of going back and forth talking about things. I learned so much in the perspective. It's wonderful. So awesome job here. Let's hit two more articles so we're comprehensive in our review and walkthrough of the 2025 literature. We won't spend too much time reviewing the studies because we've hit them in deeper dive on earlier podcasts, but let's just hit something on post-intubation sedation. I think most of us would agree that propofol tends to be the most widely used post-intubation sedative for our mechanically ventilated patients. But I think we can also acknowledge that overall, there's a trend towards increasing utilization of other agents, namely dexmedetomidine. So in 2025, in JAMA, the A2B trial was published. And if you recall, this looked at a dexmedetomidine or clonidine-based sedation strategy compared with propofol in critically ill mechanically ventilated patients. And you think about clonidine, and that is utilized in some areas of the world for sedation. Now, in terms of overall, the objective A2B was really looking at the effectiveness and the safety of a dexmedetomidine and clonidine-based sedation versus propofol done in 41 ICUs in the UK. In adults who were ventilated in the ICU, were initially sedated with propofol after intubation, and were expected to require about 24 hours or more of mechanical ventilation. They were then randomized to dexmedetomidine, clonidine, or propofol. In essence, they were looking at the time from randomization to when that patient could successfully be extubated, looking at a number of secondary and safety outcomes. Overall, they included a little over 1,400 patients, relatively evenly divided between the three groups, and looking at the primary outcome of time to successful extubation, it really wasn't different between dexmedetomidine compared with propofol, clonidine versus propofol. No significant difference in the secondary outcomes of staying in the ICU longer, so ICU length of stay, 180-day all-cause mortality, but the incidence of agitation was higher in those that received dexmedetomidine over those first 7 days. In addition, there was a higher prevalence of bradycardia, no surprise here based on its mechanism of action in the dex group compared with propofol, and a higher incidence of cardiac arrhythmias. So at the end of the day, these authors report that really looking at a dexmedetomidine-based sedation strategy didn't change the time to successful extubation, wasn't any sooner, but in fact did have higher rates of agitation, bradycardia, and arrhythmias in that dex group when compared to propofol. So for this study, Dr. Rodriguez, let's go to you first.
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't start with me because I found this study very confusing. I simply don't use clonidine in the ICU, or at least for not for that purpose. So I didn't quite know what to do with this study that included a protocol where clonidine was a big part of their sedation.
Sounds good, Rob. Peter, what say you about this particular study?
I echo Rob in saying our experience with clonidine as a sedative is not there. They do give a mention that this is uncomfortable, and so patients should be sedated with fentanyl, which Surviving Sepsis Campaign and Society of Critical Care Medicine have both advocated for giving something for pain because it's uncomfortable to be intubated. So I'm not surprised that that's mentioned. I think it could have been mentioned a little bit more. And then my big push with propofol is always the hypotension that's associated with it, and that might cause me to switch over to dex in those cases. And then speaking about that, not surprising that dex is going to have more agitation and bradycardia as well.
Good points, Peter. All right, John, close us out here on this particular study, and then we'll come down the home stretch with our last one. So, your thoughts on the A2B trial?
Absolutely. So I think our ICU colleagues listening are comfortable with using dexmedetomidine in certain circumstances. For our emergency medicine colleagues listening, I think the big takeaway here is that we have to be really careful in that peri-intubation period. And dexmedetomidine does allow for awareness, and it's a little bit of a different sedation strategy if you're not using it routinely in your practice. So particularly in a patient who's just been intubated, has recently received rocuronium, maybe paralyzed for the next 2 hours or so. This is a really important takeaway that this trial should not change your practice. Continue to use propofol and other sedatives so that your patients are not aware and paralyzed for a period of time while in the ED. I continue to use propofol routinely post-intubation, and then once they're up in the ICU, if they're improving, consider transition to dexmedetomidine at times, but that's a different location and time of taking care of the patient.
Yeah, really well stated, John. And I think another component here for me is that certainly many more clinicians are utilizing dexmedetomidine. And I would highlight just it does have those adverse effects, as does propofol, has its own, but just as more get experience with respect to the bradycardia, perhaps a little bit more agitation, and the arrhythmias that this can induce, be sure to monitor for that. All right, let's wrap it up. One last article to touch on. I think it's a really important article that I'm really interested in the three of your thoughts on this. And we talked about this early in 2025, and that deals with palliative care in the emergency department. This was the PRIME ER study published in JAMA. And as many of us know, the importance of palliative care interventions in the emergency department, initiating that can be hugely beneficial for patients and their families. And so this particular study overall wanted to assess the effectiveness of a multi-component primary palliative care intervention in the ED. Now, they go into good detail or great detail in the study about specialty palliative care and how those particular resources are fairly limited. So, if there was an intense educational campaign to give primary palliative care education to our physicians, our NPs, our PAs, our nurses, would that then have an effect overall in patients where primary care, palliative care may be appropriate? So this was done 29 emergency departments across the US. They included emergency physicians, our APP colleagues of nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and nurses. And overall, they were randomized into basically one of two interventions where they got this intense primary palliative care education versus not, and looked at what was the incidence of hospital admission as a primary outcome, with secondary outcomes of overall 6 month survival, 6 month healthcare use. They included almost 100,000 patients in this particular analysis. And what they reported is there wasn't any significant difference in hospital admission rates for these patients a little bit older and overall thought to be appropriate for palliative care, no difference in the secondary outcomes, and lots of limitations to go through. But the take-home message that the authors reported is that this multi-component strategy of primary palliative care intervention in these EDs actually didn't lessen hospital admissions, didn't lessen subsequent healthcare use, or didn't change short-term mortality for older patients with a life-limiting illness. Peter, I'm going to go to you first, because I recall when we hit the real deep dive on this particular study, you had some strong thoughts, and are they still present?
Those thoughts remain. So where we need to be excellent is not just in our procedure, not just in our problem solving, but most importantly in our conversations with our sickest patients and their families. So part of what we should be doing is training our clinicians to be expert in goals of care conversations with our patients and their family members. And then the second piece is not just having that conversation, but documenting that conversation in a note that can be easily identified and flagged that helps subsequent providers. Because I may be very clever and may be eloquent and may be able to get the patient in a very good situation or the family in a very good situation, and then document that in a component of my note that nobody else is going to care to read. But if I flag it in its separate note as a goals of care conversation and in my system flag it so that we know what those end of life care decisions are, whether that's a DNR, whether it's a DNI, whether it's comfort care measures only, that is what helps our patients and their families move forward.
Outstanding thoughts, Peter. Thanks so much for those. John, I'm going to go to you next. And then, Rob, you're going to close us out on this study and this podcast.
Not a lot of major groundbreaking thoughts here. Thinking about this trial again reminded me of an article I just recently read in JACC by, I think it was Harlan Krumholtz, who is the editor in chief. And it was called The Day I Became a Doctor. And what the article was, his remembering a time in which he really didn't feel like he was a real doctor, despite having a busy practice, really clinically excellent. But when he sat down and had a meaningful conversation and took a couple extra minutes to actually talk to a patient who just spent a ton of time getting ready for her visit with him. And this is somewhat similar to that, if I can draw the line back to the palliative care thing. While it may not have changed clinical outcomes, I guarantee the amount of time that those people sat and talked with these families made a big difference in an outcome that probably wasn't measured in this trial. And so I think that the important outcomes, maybe if this trial was redone or done a different way in a future date, they might change the outcome to something related to patient experience or family experience, because I think that's where these kind of conversations really hit home.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, John. Both of you and Peter have said this amazingly well for this particular study. Rob, I'm confident you're going to wrap us up with some continuing insightful comments.
Yeah, I just love what Peter and John said. This study, where I was at San Francisco General, was part of this study. And I think the outcome measures of hospital admissions and so forth, not really, as John mentioned, not really the right outcome. The outcome measure is the experience for the family, the experience for the patients, and so forth. So I don't think that this article should dissuade us in any way from beginning those conversations about end of life care for our patients. And I think both of you put it beautifully. Thank you for that.
Well, I have to extend my thanks to the three of you. Really wonderful podcast here. Always insightful comments, really dissecting and providing, really applying all of these things and having significant and meaningful conversations around these articles. I hope that all of you have learned as much as I have over this podcast. We know it's a little bit long, tends to be longer than our roughly 30 minutes, and that's because we're taking a look back over the preceding year over some key articles from the 2025 literature. So with that, we're going to bring this podcast to a close. Please, as always, continue this conversation outside of the podcast. Continue sending us emails. We love hearing from you. Ask us questions. Give us your thoughts about these particular articles and how you would approach the including this information or not in your daily practice in resuscitating critically ill patients, whether you're in the ED or in the ICU. We're going to look forward to speaking with you on our very next podcast here on CCPEM. Bye for now.